You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
My name is Bruce Jones. I'm the Vice President and the Director of Foreign Policy here at Brookings, and it's my honor to welcome all of you here in the room and online. Thank you for coming and spending the evening with us. Convening debate among top policy minds has long been an essential part of the culture at Brookings, but as we approach our 100th year, we're trying to innovate and find new ways of doing that, find dynamic new ways to generate debate and to generate serious conversation among policy experts and decision makers. And tonight we're continuing this new series. It's not just an enjoyable way to spend an evening, combining serious policy debate and alcohol. That's not a bad way to go. But also a way to generate serious conversation among thought leaders on some of the most important issues of the day. And this sure counts. The issue at hand is perhaps the biggest foreign policy question in the moment, whether or not the United States should move forward with the Iran nuclear deal and what happens beyond. Congress will be voting on this issue as early as this week, but of course this is an issue which will continue to occupy American foreign policy for a long time to come. We want to hear what you have to think, both in the room and online. If you have not already voted on our poll, please do so now. There are instructions on the screen and in the handout you had as you came in. And tonight we have a real treat, an opportunity to listen to a discussion and a debate among some of the biggest thinkers on foreign policy in Washington. I'm particularly delighted to welcome Senator John McCain back to Brookings. Senator, when you were here some time back and talked about Syria, I wrote at the time that I thought your statement was bound to become the rallying point for conservative opposition to the administration's policy on Syria, and I was wrong. It was, without any question, the most clearly articulated critique from any position of the policy on Syria, and I appreciate your willingness to engage with us here and to offer your view on these critical issues. And I'm delighted to welcome the rest of my colleagues at Brookings to stage on both sides of the debate. Without further ado, I'm going to get off the stage and hand it to a professional, that is to say Major Garrett, who will moderate the debate. Major Garrett was, in November of 2012, named to be CBS's chief White House correspondent. As such, he reports for all CBS News broadcasts and platforms and is a substitute anchor on Face the Nation. You've all seen him on TV. While covering the White House for CBS News, he's traveled extensively with the president to Asia, to Europe, to the Middle East. He's reported on presidential actions to confront ISIS and Ebola and Russia, and, of course, on the Iran negotiations. He's supremely well qualified to lead the debate today. Major, thank you for joining us, and over to you.
Thanks very much, Bruce. It's a full house. Welcome to everyone who's here in the overflow room. It's great to be invited to participate in this very important debate. It's been a newsy day on the Iran deal, as I'm sure all of you know. We'll get to some of the news that was made today, in addition to what happened in the Senate with the announcement of support for the deal. The White House, as I was coming over, issued its veto threat for the motion of disapproval. We'll get into all of that. But before, as Bruce suggested, what we want to do here is capture the thoughts in the room and online and in the overflow room about what you think about the Iran deal now, before you have a chance to hear our four panelists, and then what you hear and what you think after you've heard the four panelists. And there's a process, of course, to vote, and I'd like to walk you through that. We have a pre-debate poll, which will close in about 5 minutes or so. If you want to participate in that pre-debate poll and let us know what you're thinking about the merits of the deal, whether you're in favor or not, or if you don't know, that's another option, here's what you do. You text the word Brookings to 22333. If you are in favor of the deal, you think Congress should approve it, text 1. If you think Congress should disapprove the deal, text 2. And in a new wrinkle for this format, if you are undecided, text 3. Now, we added the undecided element to create a space for those who genuinely are undecided, if any are, and so we could also find out after you've heard the four presenters if any minds have actually been changed. So, and that's true here in the room, and if those of you who are choosing to vote online, the voting information is on your screen on the streaming video that you are watching. And we encourage, of course, because this is a Twitter-happy nation and a Twitter-happy city, to engage on Twitter, and the hashtag is, hashtag, very clever, Brookings Debate. I'm told in the script here this will be a very structured and fast-moving debate. I guess that's my obligation, so I better live up to it. Here's how we're going to do it. It's Oxford style. I really don't know what that means because I've never been to Oxford. But it really sounds great, don't you think? Oxford style debate. 5 minutes from the presenters, then I will conduct an open question of those after they make their presentations, and then closing statements of 2 minutes. Those are all timed very precisely. There will be lights, and if the lights tell me, I will then jump in. Not literally, but I will encourage those who are speaking to wrap it up, and we can move along. Then we'll have, as I suggested earlier, a second vote on what you think about what you've heard and the underlying merits of the Iran deal. Now, I don't need to explain the Iran deal to those here in the room or stream or watching online or in the overflow room, but a couple of things happened today. One is Senate Democrats secured and the White House 41 votes, which means the motion to disapprove that will be considered in the Senate is now subject to a successful filibuster if, in fact, that's what the Democrats decide to do. The White House encouraged them to do that today. Ben Cardin, the ranking member of the Foreign Relations Committee, said that was always implied in the underlying legislation. So did Tim Kaine, Democratic senator from Virginia. Republicans said, why would you filibuster something if you support it? Why don't you have a vote and let the country see? That's part of the debate procedurally that sort of is an umbrella over the underlying merits of the deal, which we'll get into very much. As I was coming over in the cab, as I mentioned, the White House issued its veto threat with a lengthy list of objections to a motion of disapproval. We'll get into that with our panelists as well. So you've got about 30 seconds more in the pre-debate poll if you want to register your opinion. The one last thing I will say before I invite our four panelists up here is I've been covering the Obama White House for the better part of 6 years, and if there is one brief that the president has carried throughout his presidency, one thing he has constantly monitored and deeply involved himself in the underlying details of, it has been, first, the method to obtain a nuclear deal with Iran, its underlying specifics, the verification regime. He believes he knows this issue cold and therefore describes his support for it and his curiosity about opposition to it in very stark ways. That has sometimes left Republicans a bit annoyed. But that is the political reality. The president does believe he has achieved the best deal imaginable, and we're now going to get into the merits of what that deal is, what it isn't, and what the future may hold. So if I can now let you know, the polls are closed and the pre-debate survey we're taking. I can invite all four of our participants up to the stage, and we'll begin tonight's conversation. Okay, sure. And I'll go to the center podium because that's where I've just told to go. So here we go. There we go. There we go. Turn on the button. Everyone has taken their seats. Just so you know, John McCain and Leon Wieselt here will argue for disapproval of the Iran deal. Suzanne Maloney and Bruce Rydell will argue in favor of its approval. And we shall begin the conversation and the debate with Suzanne Maloney, who is the deputy director in foreign policy here at Brookings, and a senior fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy, also here at Brookings. Suzanne, the podium is yours.
Thank you and good evening. I'm honored to be here tonight sharing the stage with Senator McCain and two of my most distinguished Brookings colleagues. I'm used to following in the wake of such powerful voices, but on this night, on this issue, I'm eager to lead off our discussion. And that's because I'm convinced that Congress has an obligation to vote to approve the recently concluded nuclear deal between Iran, the United States, and five other world powers. The obligation is not just a strategic one, but a moral one. Allow me in my remaining time to explain. First, by any measure, this is a good arms control deal. It provides deep reductions in Iran centrifuge numbers and its stockpile of low-enriched uranium. That means that the deal extends the breakout timeline, the time that it would take Iran to rush toward a bomb without a deal, from a matter of weeks to at least a year for at least a decade. The deal imposes strict limits on research and development for a decade. It blocks the plutonium pathway to weapons capability for the foreseeable future. And it institutes advanced verification and monitoring for the full range of nuclear-related activities, from mining to manufacturing and beyond. Iran's incentives under the deal are not forthcoming until and unless it fulfills its major, potentially irreversible actions to curb its own nuclear program. There's plenty else to like about this deal, its level of detail, its procedures for dispute resolution, even its planning for failure through clever procedures for snapping back United Nations sanctions. But even if you don't like the deal, consider the alternatives. There is no renegotiation. If somehow, some way, Congress manages to kill the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, as the deal is known, we go back to the bargaining table alone. Our partners at the negotiating table, the powerful states of Russia, China, the European three, have made it very clear, including in conversations with members of Congress. Many in Congress may not be satisfied with this deal. Many in this country may not be satisfied. But the world, the rest of the world, has indicated that it is. Secondly, there is no scenario in which sanctions will be strengthened. Just examine the track record of the past 36 years. In which we failed repeatedly, even after horrific provocations by Tehran, to generate sufficient political will among even our closest allies or our adversaries to adhere to any sanctions at all on Iran. Washington can try to up the ante with new measures, and given the reach and weight of the U.S. financial system, we may even see a little bit of additional compliance for a while. Ultimately, however, an attempt to intensify pressure without that multilateral coalition will fail, and at no small cost to America's own economy. Russia, China, they have their own experience with sanctions as targets of U.S. economic pressure, and the rest of the international community sees no interest in perpetual economic pressure on Tehran. There is no military solution. We cannot bomb away Iran's nuclear infrastructure and its know-how. Even the most ambitious scenarios for military strikes would at best set back Tehran's program by a year or two or maybe three. They would no doubt then incite a much more determined effort by Iran to acquire nuclear weapons capability. There is no regime change. I've spent time in Tehran and a couple of decades studying the country, and no one has fewer illusions about Iran than I do. But let's be frank here. The idea of an opposition movement engineered by Washington, sponsored by Washington, even championed by Washington, that actually succeeds in overthrowing the Islamic Republic is naive. If you don't believe that, Manasher Gubranifar and Ahmad Chalabi have a few bridges to sell you. The realistic alternative to this deal is not a better deal. And it's also not war, as the administration has sometimes argued. It's simply a much less attractive deal. The last time America turned its back on the possibility of resolving the nuclear issue, we lost the chance to curtail Iran's nuclear activities at a much more preliminary stage. How will history judge Congress for scuttling a diplomatic resolution today? Third, let me get to the heart of what I believe motivates much of the opposition to this agreement. Many of the criticisms of the deal are not about the terms or even about the alternatives, but simply because critics abhor the fact, the idea of striking a deal with a quintessentially bad actor. They're outraged at the notion that Iran is going to be let out of the international penalty box without conclusively terminating its entire nuclear program or any of the other offenses that have contributed to its recent pariah status. I understand that outrage. I even sympathize with it. However, we've tried maximalism on Iran during the early years of the Bush administration, and it got us nowhere. It neither forced Iran to capitulate on its nuclear program nor halted its advances around the region. Our partners in the P5+1 signed on to a negotiating process was restricted quite deliberately by the Bush administration to the nuclear issue as the paramount concern about Iran's foreign policy. This was the only viable construct for the talks, since all of the countries that we've been negotiating with have very different approaches to the other concerns we have with Iranian policies. Until now, the only party that sought to broaden the conversation was Tehran, usually as a means of avoiding nuclear concessions. Go it alone didn't work for the Bush administration, and it won't work now. But here's the good news. The nuclear deal is not the sum total of U.S. policy toward Tehran, nor should it be. We can't renegotiate the deal, but we can construct a better Iran policy, one that does begin to curtail Iran's malign influence around the region and its support for terrorist organizations.
Susan, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up.
We've arrived, as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said earlier this year when he addressed Congress, at a fateful crossroads. The paths available to the United States are clear. Washington can continue to lead the broadest and most effective coalition in implementing an agreement that sets back Tehran's proximity to nuclear weapons capability for at least a decade, or we can strike out on our own, alienating our allies, ceding our leverage, and leaving the Islamic Republic only 2 months away from nuclear capability. That's no choice at all. Congress should approve this deal.
Susan, thank you very much. Senator John McCain.
Well, if you'd like, I'll just
that's fine.
Emote from here. Thank all of you for coming. When I come back to Brookings, I always mention that it's always wonderful to see old friends and enemies again. And those in the overflow room, I notice there's quite a bit of alcohol back there. Some of you may want to join that. Thank you. It's great to be back. I had some prepared remarks, but I think maybe I just mention the scenario in which we are considering, and the debate will start tomorrow after noon. First of all, as Major Garrett just pointed out, the president probably has enough votes to sustain a veto. And I'm sure that that is a great triumph for those who greatly favor this agreement. I'd also like to point out, and I am a student of history, it's the first time in history that an agreement will be voted on a strict party line basis. Strict party line basis. Not a single Republican senator will be voting in favor of this agreement. You can draw your own conclusions as to what the ramifications of that are, but they're not good. They're not good. Either somebody failed in outreach or somebody failed somewhere to at least obtain a degree of bipartisanship, which has characterized every other treaty and agreement major throughout our history, including the one I remember that was so controversial, was the Panama Canal Treaty. At least there were some Republicans that voted for that. I think also we are talking about Iran here as if it were on another planet somewhere, and that we were just discussing the virtues or the downsides of this agreement. I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you do that. They're in control in four countries at least. They recently, in Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon, recently they're giving weapons to the Taliban in Afghanistan. They're still the world's single most important sponsor of terrorism. Tried to plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador here in Washington, D.C. They're on the move, my friends. They're on the march. And they're not relenting, nor has there been any indication whatsoever of a change in their behavior. And they're going to now get 100 billion, whatever it is. Is there any belief whatsoever of anyone? Please raise your hand if you think that they aren't going to use a hell of a lot of that money to pursue their hegemonic ambitions in the region. So we're handing them tens of billions of dollars that they can now freely support the Quds force, extend their influence in Lebanon, to continue the Houthis in Yemen, whatever activities that they want to continue, motivated by their, of course, Mr. Soleimani, who takes selfies outside of Baghdad as he leads the Shiite militias in their attempts to regain control of Iraq for Iranian purposes. And by the way, the individual who was responsible, according to General Dunford, incoming chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mr. Soleimani, was responsible for the deaths of at least 500, count them, 500 soldiers and Marines' deaths. I have no idea how many wounded. Mr. Soleimani is going to have a blank check right now to continue his activities. The world is in chaos, my friends. We are seeing nothing like we have not seen since the end of World War II. We all know that. Does anybody disagrees with that? Of course not. And why did this happen? It's because of the failed policies of this president and this administration. The guy that wouldn't speak up, this president who would not speak up in 2009 when Iranians were demonstrating in the streets of Tehran and a young woman named Netta bled to death, and we saw her picture, and they were chanting, "Obama, Obama, you with us or you with them?" And not a word was spoken on their behalf. And so now we see the Middle East in chaos. But we're going to treat this agreement as if it took place in some more sterile and less interesting environment. And finally, let me just say that I've seen some bad deals in my time. And I take particular exception to the president telling the American people that there are only two options, war or this agreement. And I can tell you, before the Armed Services Committee, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dempsey, said, "I can tell you we have a range of options, and I always present them. June 29, 2015, I think there are other options besides going to war." Navy Admiral John Richardson, President Obama's nominee to the next chief of naval operation. So I really am upset about the intellectual dishonesty here, that we only have two choices. Obviously, there are many others, and that's according to our military leadership. My friends, this is a seminal moment, and we need to engage and discuss this entire situation in the Middle East, not just this, but the deteriorating chaos that now envelops the entire Middle East. We need to have that conversation with the American people. Thank you.
Senator McCain, thank you very much. We now turn to Bruce Riedel. Bruce is the director of the Intelligence Project and a senior fellow in foreign policy at Brookings. You can have the table or you can have the podium, as you prefer, Bruce.
I follow the senator's example, particularly as I have a broken toe, so it'll be much more pleasant to sit here. Before I begin, I want to say what an honor it is to be here with you, Senator. It's an honor to be with everybody, but it's particularly an honor to be here with an American hero, particularly one who's had the courage to speak out against torture. I only wish that more of my colleagues at the CIA had followed his path. We have a very, very big agenda here. I just want to cover a couple of points because I think Suzanne has set the stage. First of all, is there a better deal available? I don't think there is a better deal available. I think it's built into the inherent structure of these negotiations. It's not a six-party agreement with Iran. It's actually an eight-party agreement with Iran, the European Union and the UN Security Council. All of those other parties have already announced that they intend to implement this resolution no matter what the Congress does, and they've also indicated they're not going back to the negotiating table. So if you think there's an alternative where we go back to negotiations, I'm afraid there isn't. Is that a good thing? Maybe not. But it's a fait accompli, and it was demonstrated dramatically last Friday when the King of Saudi Arabia came here, and despite everyone knowing he doesn't really like this deal, he moved on and said it's time to accept the fact that it's here, and he reluctantly and somewhat sullenly endorsed it. That gets to my second point about the regional reaction. The region has already moved on. It is accepted that this deal is going to be a fait accompli, and it's going to be the reality that we have to deal with. I agree completely with the senator. The Middle East is in flames as we have never seen it before. This is one of the most dangerous moments in the history of the Middle East, and the Iranian regime is up to no good. But it's better to have a deal with Iran that keeps it from being a nuclear weapons state and building an arsenal than it is to allow it to move to that stage next. If the Congress of the United States votes against this deal and somehow overturns a presidential veto, the regional reaction will be confusion. People won't understand how the American system works. They'll only know that the American system doesn't speak with one voice, and they will react in a consequent manner. Confusion, doubt about what America stands for and where America stands on this deal. I have no illusions about the Iranians. I have buried colleagues who've been murdered and tortured to death by the Iranians. I know what they are going to do with additional money. It is still better to find a path to keep them from developing nuclear weapons. The third issue I want to look at briefly is, does this deal put Israel at risk? We're hearing from a lot of commentators today that this deal is the equivalent of the Munich Agreement of 1938, that this deal somehow will create an Israel which is Czechoslovakia in 1939, shorn of the Sudetenland and thrown under the bus. I don't believe that for a minute. The state of Israel is a very powerful and strong state. It is fully capable of defending itself, thanks in large part, but not only in large part, to American assistance over the last four decades. Israel has strategic superiority and the qualitative edge not only over Iran, but any combination of its enemies conceivable today. Israeli has the strongest conventional military in the entire region. The Israeli Air Force flies F-15Is, the state-of-the-art jet fighter. It will soon be flying F-35s. The Iranians are flying state-of-the-art equipment from America, too, provided by the Shah in 1975. F-14s, there's no competition there. Secondly, Israel has the best intelligence system in the entire Middle East. Believe me, I've worked with them. They know more than anyone else about what's going on in Iran. And third, Israel is a nuclear weapon state. I know the saying that is verboten in the Israeli government and verboten in the United States government, but Israel has between 80 and 200 nuclear weapons. It has three means of delivering nuclear weapons: the F-15s and F-35s we provide, French origin Jericho intermediate range ballistic missiles, and six Dolphin-class U-boats provided by Germany with cruise missile capabilities. Israel, even in a worst-case scenario, is more than fully capable of defending itself. Efraim Halevi, a close colleague and friend of 30 years, the former chief of the Mossad, has said Israel is the biggest beneficiary of this deal in the region, and I think he knows what he's talking about. In short, I think the challenge for the United States here is that Suzanne alluded to. We need to figure out ways we can bolster our allies' capability to deal with the other threats Iran poses after this agreement is put into place, particularly the terrorism, subversion, and political evil that Iran is likely to be up to.
Bruce, thank you very much. Leon Wieseltier will now argue, voting to disapprove. Leon is the Isaiah Berlin Senior Fellow in Culture and Policy that is jointly appointed in the Governance Studies and Foreign Policy programs here at Brookings. Leon, the table or the podium, as you choose, is yours.
Is this on you? My opposition to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action has primarily two grounds. The first is that the accord fails to accomplish the objective that it sets out for itself, which is an objective that we all, I mean all sides in this debate, share. That objective, as the President has said, is to block every one of Iran's paths to a bomb. Based on the text of the agreement and on the various pronouncements about it by our senior officials, it seems perfectly uncontroversial to me to insist that this deal does not do that. It provides for a respite of 10 years and then a partial respite of another 5 years. But a respite from a problem is not a release from a problem. We have not been emancipated from our abundantly warranted anxiety about Iran's nuclear capabilities and intentions. We have only been given some help in anxiety management. If during that 10-year period the Iranians don't lie and our respite is not consumed by verification controversies, which is a very big if, then we will have accomplished only a successful postponement to another presidency of the excruciating questions which this presidency has clearly despaired of finding a genuine solution for. The most significant fact about this negotiation was that the Iranian regime never made a strategic decision to renounce nuclear weapons. Instead, it made a tactical decision to defer nuclear weapons. It is true that the agreement states not once but twice that, quote, Iran reaffirms that under no circumstances will Iran ever seek, develop, or acquire a nuclear weapon. But the Iranian refusal to provide an accurate account of its military programs so far and the very structure of this deal which legitimates and acknowledges the eventual resumption of Iran's enrichment activities at levels that have no purpose whatsoever for the civilian use of nuclear energy, indicates to me that no Iranian renunciation of its military nuclear ambition has occurred or is likely to occur as long as this regime persists. When my old friend and colleague Tony Blinken tells Congress that we cannot sanction or negotiate or bomb Iran out of its knowledge of how to enrich, he is, of course, correct. But there are other states who are in possession of the same knowledge, and we are not losing any sleep about their plans for the application of what they know. The strategic decision that the Islamic Republic did make, by contrast, was to find a way out of the increasingly crushing sanctions into which their nuclear adventurism had cast them. So for me, the Joint Comprehensive Plan represents a change of degree, not a change in kind. It is true that a lot of arms control has aspired only to that, but not all arms control. From the standpoint of Iran's interests, the renunciation of nuclear weapons would have been a perfectly rational course of action. And the administration likes to assure us that this regime is indeed rational. Yet it pointedly chose no such course of action. And one of the reasons, surely, is that its interlocutors, I mean us, did not insist that they consider it. Instead, we made a prior assessment about what is and is not possible in terms of Iranian flexibility. Good and honest people can disagree about that assessment, but we can all agree that it was decisive for determining the outcome of the negotiation. Good and honest people can also disagree about the deal itself. It is not hard to understand an argument for a respite in all situations of tremendous pressure. That is why I do not oppose the deal apocalyptically, since I do not believe that it has permanently or even for a long time altered our strategic circumstances. I regard it as having only moderately mitigated a threat that continues to haunt the region and the world. All the ominous options must remain on all the infamous table. The other grounds for my opposition is that in exchange for such a limited and passing amelioration, the deal will strengthen a contemptible and aggressive regime. The meanings of the deal for foreign policy must be considered along with its meanings for national security. Insofar as this deal represents some sort of rapprochement with Iran, a beginning of a détente with the Islamic Republic, it seeks to accomplish a goal that is, in my view, inimical to American interests and American values. I know it is somewhat heretical to introduce values into conversations these days. Many people regard values, or at least some of them, as the slippery slope to shock and awe. But it is not always the case that conflict is based on a misunderstanding or a mistake. Sometimes conflict is a sign that fundamental differences have been accurately understood. Our previous hostility to the Islamic Republic was not based on a misreading of the Islamic Republic in its conduct within its borders or in its conduct beyond its borders. The text of the agreement mentions, quote, a desire to build a new relationship with Iran, close quote. Not a new relationship with a new Iran, but a new relationship with this Iran, with a criminal, oppressive, theocratic, bellicose, anti-American, anti-Semitic, misogynistic, and homophobic regime that is consecrated not only to its God, but also to the thwarting of American purposes and American allies, and to the remorseless support of terrorism. What Democrat, what pluralist, what liberal, what conservative, what believer, what non-believer would want this Iran for a friend? What constructive role can this Iran, I know it opposes ISIS, play in the community of nations? It is important to note that during the period of the negotiations, Iran was intervening ferociously to inflame the Shia in Iraq, to prop up Assad in Syria, to support Hezbollah in Lebanon, and to arm Hamas in Gaza. Unlike us and our policies in the same conflicts, Iran was not inhibited in its interventions by the fear of upsetting its interlocutors during a delicate negotiations. Nor should the Islamic Republic's loud and regular calls for the destruction of Israel be treated as some sort of foible or eccentricity to be sighed over while we go about the really important business. So insofar as this arms deal represents a new beginning in our relations with Iran, the vile behavior of Iran is germane to the discussion. Vile is a non-professional term, I know, but it seems clinically precise for the patron of the Syrian slaughterhouse. It is also important to note that when one speaks about an unfree country, when one utters the word Iran, for example, one may be referring either to its regime or to its people, but not to both, because they are not on the same side. The Obama administration has not grasped this, and so its overtures to Iran have had the effect of engaging and invigorating only the regime.
Leon, need you to wrap it up.
Almost done.
Okay.
Moreover, the idea that Iranian society will be significantly opened up by the economic windfall that will result from the suspension of sanctions is absurd. A great deal of saddening but serious evidence exists that economic liberalization need not entail political liberalization. If the Ayatollahs and the IRGC have not opened up their society until now, it is not because they lack the cash. Thank you.
All right, we're going to get to the stage of the debate where I'm going to try to encourage our four panelists to engage each other directly, and we're going to start here. To Suzanne and Bruce, Senator McCain said not a single Republican will vote for this, and he considers that a bad sign for the deal, a bad sign for history, and a failure of the administration. Would you say the problem was with the deal or with Republicans? Don't worry, Senator. I think I know the answer to that one.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
So go.
Let me jump in first, but I would hope that Bruce will follow in my wake. I think it is a sad statement on the character of politics today in Washington. And what's truly unfortunate about it is that so much of our Iran policy has been bipartisan. What we have constructed, what brought us to this deal, what made these negotiations effective, was an effort between both Congress and presidents from two parties to construct a strategy to create a really coherent coalition that imposed the kind of pressure that Iran brought Iran back to the table that has had an impact on its domestic politics. And yet, despite that bipartisan agreement about the objectives of U.S. policy, about the need to engage in negotiations with Iran, which was not an Obama administration innovation, it was, in fact, a decision by George W. Bush, to understand that maximalism wasn't going to be effective, we have lost bipartisanship today. And I think that that's less about the deal than it is about the quality of politics today in Washington.
Bruce?
Okay.
There you go.
I agree with Suzanne. The problem is not the Republican Party, although the Republican Party has many problems today, as The Economist has brilliantly shown this week. The problem is American politics, which have moved into
the Democrat Party, however, is in great shape.
No, it's not in very good shape either. Both of them are having a lot of trouble. Let me...
That will be the next Brookings
point,
debate, by the way.
Let me look at a different point. The Middle East today that we are living with is an incredibly confused and gray area. We've already heard some of the contents about the Iranian regime. The Iranian regime is a regime trying to subvert our closest allies in the region, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and others. It is also our most significant partner in the war against ISIS and the defense of Baghdad. That's not a statement of opinion. It's a statement of fact of what's going on in Iraq today. I'm not advocating a rapprochement with Iran. I think that would be a fool's errand. What I am saying is that unlike the black and white situation we seem to see in Washington on Capitol Hill, the real situation in the Middle East is filled with grays, a lot of black, and very little white. And that's the situation that this deal ought to be evaluated in the context of.
Senator McCain, the suggestion is this is all politics, and that the bipartisanship that led to the formation of this policy is somehow now instantly being subverted purely for politics. That's the allegation. I want you to respond.
Well, first of all, could I say thank you, Bruce, for your kind words. But let me say that, I mean that about torture. I thank you. To have some kind of equivalency between Israel having nuclear weapons and Iran having nuclear weapons, that is not intellectually honest.
I never suggested a moral equivalency.
You pointed out
between.
That Israel has all these nuclear weapons and they have this and that as far as nukes are concerned. There is no equivalence. Israel has never had demonstrations, death to Iran, death to America. Israel is a country surrounded by nations committed to its extinction. And that's why We are glad they have, overjoyed that they have nuclear weapons. So I just wanted to clear that up. But the second thing is that I voted for sanctions and sought sanctions against Iran, not so much because of their path toward nuclear weapons, because of their aggression in the entire region. And by the way, the fact that there are Iranians in Baghdad today that are orchestrating effort against ISIS is no greater example of the collapse of American influence, of what happens when you withdraw. When you leave, my friends, there's a vacuum and others fill it. I am deeply alarmed that it's Iranians that are our friends in Baghdad. So I voted for sanctions against Iran because of the long record of hegemonic behavior, of the atrocious treatment of their own people, of four Americans who are still being held captured, one a reporter for the Washington Post. Why wasn't that in the negotiations, for God's sake? And their entire behavior throughout the region, anti-democratic, hegemonic, and trying to realize the ambitions that they are obviously pretty successful now that the United States has basically left the region. No, I take that back. We have trained 60 people.
54.
Yeah, number of them captured. So I take it back. We're doing a lot there. So the point is, I think, is that the Iranians are about to receive a crowning victory. And if there is the slightest indication that that is going to change their behavior in the region, I will be glad to see what that indication is.
Leon, please jump in. It seems like you
are. I think I don't know what we mean when we say – I'm not sure what Suzanne means or what we mean when we say that we once had a maximalist position towards the regime in Iran. If we did, we certainly now have a minimalist position. We have gone from overreach to underreach without stopping at reach, as far as I can tell. When I am not prepared to look the Iranian people in the eyes and tell them there is no possibility of regime change. By regime change, I do not mean the Iraq war. I just want to say that 50,000 times. All right? Not the Iraq war. Now we can move on. There is in Iraq there were no indigenous democratic movement when you sort of scornfully mentioned Chalabi. I share your scorn, but nobody is proposing anything like that. There was and is an indigenous popular democratic movement with Western sympathies in a country that beneath its repression includes a significantly Western oriented society. It is a country. The change of regime in Tehran is not only, as far as I can tell, a moral obligation of ours. That is not to change the regime, but to help those people in Iran who want to change the regime. There is strategically no greater prize in the region than I can think of than an eventual, not the Iraq war, change of regime in Tehran.
I share your aspirations for a democratic Iran, but I see absolutely no possibility in the past 60 years of American policy toward Iran that we have any capacity
to influence
that. How about when they were demonstrating in the streets over corrupt election, and they were about to overthrow the government, we wouldn't even speak up in their behalf.
It was even worse than that. They were calling Obama.
Most of the people who are demonstrating in the street today support this deal. Many of the leaders of that movement have come out publicly in favor of this deal. They do not believe further sanctions, further securitization of Iranian politics are in the interests of a democratic movement in Iran.
My understanding,
they are the people who understand what's happening on the ground best, not people sitting here in ivory towers in Washington.
Well, look, we all sit wherever we sit. My understanding is that the dissident community in
Have you ever been to Syria lately? Have you?
I in no way...
You've never been to Syria? I've been to Syria. How many times have you been to Iraq? I've been some 22 times. How many times have you been to Kabul?
My argument is not that Iran is not
directly responsible. I resent a great deal when you say that I'm sitting in an ivory tower. When you say that I'm sitting in an ivory tower.
She meant me.
Well, anyway.
Oh, go ahead, Senator. Go ahead, Senator.
It was probably Leon. I take it all back.
She meant me.
Bruce, before I throw another question for you.
One quick point. I never suggested an equivalency between Israel and Iran, and I agree with you. We are better off Israel having nuclear weapons. My point is Israel is not a weak Czechoslovakia in the aftermath of the Munich Agreement, and that kind of argument just doesn't consist to be with the facts. I don't want to fight the Iraq War over again. I agree with you, Leon. Let's not fight the Iraq War over again. But I do remember what the late Saudi Foreign Minister Prince Saud said. He said the Bush administration handed Iraq to Iran on a silver platter. I think that's where the sin of letting the Iranians get into Iraq occurred. I agree with you completely. The Obama administration just helped them come in further. If we're going to debate all the errors of the Bush and Obama administration tonight, we'll never have any time to talk about the Iran nuclear deal.
Which I want to talk about.
I think it's very important, and we've learned this from previous episodes of arms control. Arms control can not only be evaluated in its own terms. Mm-hmm. It needs to be assessed in terms of larger strategic, historical, and even moral considerations. It seems to me obvious that since the president's first inaugural address, since his very first public pronouncement as president, that he has dreamed, for good reasons or bad, I'm speaking now just as a matter of fact, that he has dreamed of a new relationship with Iran. My own view is that many people who want a new relationship with Iran suffer from this feeling that the United States comes to Iran with some sort of prior disqualifying guilt from helping it advance towards a democratic society. But the fact is that in 2009, when those astonishingly valiant people were in the streets in Tehran and we turned our back on them, they were screaming Obama's name and he was in the White House thinking about Mossadegh. Most of the kids on the street of Tehran in 2009 were too young to even know who Mossadegh was.
They understand that history far better than most people here in Washington do. The simple reality is that we do not have the levers to influence Iranian politics. People did not leave the streets in 2009 because of what we failed to do. They left the streets because they didn't have a leadership in the opposition movement that was prepared to go to the mattresses with a very repressive regime.
We did not have the leverage.
I would like to actually get back to the question of moral responsibility, since you raised that very issue. What is our moral responsibility if we walk away from this deal? These negotiations are proof of concept of American leadership on tough foreign policy issues. We did this, not just one administration, but Congress, working with President Bush and with President Obama, built this strategy and came up with a solution. It's not a perfect solution. It's not a comprehensive solution because none of our allies are signed on to a comprehensive solution. But in fact, it solves one piece of the Iranian puzzle for a less than optimal period of time and gives us more leverage and more leeway to address the other issues. If we walk away from this deal now, how does that help Syria? How does that help Iraq?
I want to ask you two, Suzanne and Bruce, about the president's statements and the administration's evolving metrics for the deal itself. Because as someone who's been at the White House for many, many years, I remember the president saying the original concept, you just said proof of concept, was to block all available Iranian paths to a nuclear weapon and, among other things, to have a verified and comprehensive accounting for previous military dimensions of what they were doing subversively, lying to the international community and the IAEA about what was actually going on. The critics would say, A, it only delays, does not block, and there is apparently no requirement in any way that is consistent with the underlying language about verifying and accounting for the previous military dimensions of what they were doing and lying to the world about. Why does not the agreement then therefore fall, not based on what the critics say, but on what the administration said it should achieve in the first place?
This administration, like every administration engaged in negotiations, has adjusted its bar over time. I'm not shocked. That's what happens in negotiations. Let's look at the Iranian side of the bargain just for a minute. The Iranians went into this saying, we don't have any aspiration for a nuclear weapons program, and we never had an aspiration for the nuclear weapons program. Where do they stand today? They have identified facility after facility which needs to be changed in a fundamental and significant way, and the number of centrifuges reduced, all of which is an admission that they were lying up front.
Right.
Now, did we get A historical replay of the intricacies of their lying? No. And anyone who seriously thought that was going to happen does not know how negotiations really work. The key to the deal here is not whether we go back and find out what happened in 2004 or 2003 or 2007, but are we in a position now to have reasonable confidence that if they start to cheat, we will know it? And I think every expert who's looked at arms control inspections agrees that this agreement has more teeth than we've seen before. Is it perfect? No. We've put it ultimately into the hands of the International Atomic Energy Agency. And I have a great deal of confidence in that organization because its track record in the past has been very good. I promise not to fight the Iraq War again, but I'm going to fight one part of it again. The IAEA had it dead right. There was no nuclear weapons program in Iraq. I trust their verification because they've done it before. I don't trust those critics of this deal which said, oh, the next thing you hear will be a mushroom cloud.
Any reaction? Senator McCain? Leon?
Well, again, to say that the Iranian people would not go to the mattresses while the Iranian Revolutionary Guard was slaughtering them in the streets, I've heard of some revisionists of history. Anyone who, and we all did, I hope, see a young woman named Netta bleed to death in the square, that's just really quite remarkable to me. They didn't have weapons. I don't know how they would have gone to the, quote, mattresses, but they sure wanted the President of the United States, the leader of the free world, to speak up on their behalf, and he refused to do so. That is historical fact. It says, when April 6, 2015, quote, under this deal you have anywhere, anytime, 24/7 access as it relates to the nuclear facilities that Iran has. U.S. Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes. April 2, 2015, we expect to have anywhere, anytime access in the sense of a well-defined process with a well-defined end time for access to places that are suspected out-of-bounds activities. That was our energy secretary. We all know the deal allows Iran to delay inspection for 24 days before the IAEA can visit a suspected site. A majority of the 8 members and the of the Joint Commission have to approve an IAEA request for access before Tehran is obliged to comply. Iran itself would be a voting member of the commission with equal standing. The agreement specifies no means of enforcing Joint Commission rulings, although if Iran fails to comply, U.S. could terminate the agreement by invoking its snapback provision, and we know how ludicrous that is. So, and Fordo, of course, the deal concedes that Iran will convert the Fordo facility into a nuclear physics and technology center. So they've got to have a nuclear and physics and technology center inside of a mountain. Yes, sure. But they won't be enriching uranium nor have any nuclear material. And finally, I just want to get back to the conventional weapons embargo, if I could, real quick. And that is, of course, that's going to be lifted within 5 years. And both our Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, says, no, we want Iran to continue to be isolated as a military and limited in terms of the kind of equipment and material they're able to have. That embargo leaves in 5 years. And then, of course, under no circumstances should we relieve pressure on Iran relative to ballistic missile capabilities and arms trafficking. That was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs military, recommendations to the Congress. Neither of those statements are valid.
I want to put to you two gentlemen, because both Suzanne and Bruce have said there is no better deal than this deal. Voting to disapprove and making that policy, which, as we've already acknowledged, legislatively appears impossible, but it's still a position you defend. So, describe for this audience.
I'll give a very brief audience in
what the better deal looks like and how it's manifest.
Why did the Iranians come to the table to start with? Why did the Iranians come that they found themselves on the road to Damascus? Yes, they did that too. But the point is, they came to the negotiating table because their economy was hurt terribly by these sanctions. So we, of course, have and had that leverage, although we've given it up now in this agreement. But they didn't come because they wanted to see a new Middle East. They came because of an incredible punishment that was inflicted by these sanctions. That I don't think it's more complicated.
Go ahead. But if the sanctions go away.
Can I just jump in here?
Please.
What made those sanctions effective was their adherence by much of the international community, particularly by Iran's traditional major trading partners in Europe. These are countries that did not agree to sanctions after Iran seized our embassy in 1979. They did not agree to sanctions after Iran-sponsored terrorist activities against Americans and Europeans all across the Middle East and in Europe. They only agreed to sanctions as a result of the fairly unprecedented level of urgency around the Iranian nuclear issue, not about the rest of Iran's disturbing policies around
the
region. And they're not prepared to sustain them. They're not prepared to continue to adhere to them. And the Russians and the Chinese, the Indians, the Turks, all of the major purchasers of Iranian energy are not interested in further reducing their supplies in
and
this
And, of course,
market.
That assumes there's no American leadership, which there isn't. I will agree with you. There's no American leadership. There's no American pressure to,
but leadership
on these
is
other
not
countries
a magic
to,
word that forces
to,
other countries
to keep those
to
sanctions
do what we want
on. There is
to
no,
do.
There's no deal that we can say, and we should, that if they're going to do business with Iran, then they don't do business with us. That's pretty simple, and we could do that. But that's when America leads. But, you see, America doesn't lead anymore.
Are you prepared to tell the American people that there will be no further business between the United States and Europe?
I am prepared to tell the American people as to how what this deal is and what its implications are, and that there's millions of refugees now flowing into Europe and probably in the United States because of an abject failure of American leadership. And we have to restore that leadership. Otherwise, things are going to get one hell of a lot worse in the next year and a half until we have a new president. Look at a map of the world in 2009, of the Middle East in 2009. Look at a map of the Middle East today. And then tell me how things are going.
I have to say, I think that this argument, I mean, I agree with everything that my friend has just said, but I want to add that this argument that there is no alternative has always seemed a bit demagogic to me. In the first place, the argument that there is no alternative to this deal that gives a respite of 10 years and 15 years would have been made for a deal that gives a respite in 7 and 12, or a respite of 3 and 8, or a respite of 1 month and 6 months. In other words, this is some sort of casuistic game. If the deal is a bad deal, it's a bad alternative. If it's a good deal, it's a good alternative. And if the deal does not furnish the solution to the problem that it sets out to solve, then I don't understand how it can be defended as an acceptable alternative. The only thing that matters to me is that we get out of the strategic predicament posed by the Iranian desire to develop a military nuclear capability. And I see no evidence in this agreement that is what this agreement accomplishes. Moreover, given, you know, we get a Band-Aid and they get a banquet. And I have to say, I have a very, very deep fear that we are being played for fools. Because I believe that this agreement, this negotiation, was not conducted in the spirit of tough leadership that Suzanne mentioned earlier. Toughness is exactly not the word I would describe. It was conducted in a spirit of reconciliation. And I have nothing against reconciliation. Diplomats like to say that we should talk to our enemies. We should talk to our enemies.
I think
we have talked to our enemies, but they are still our enemies.
I think, in humility, we're going off track here. This is becoming a debate about the Obama administration's Middle East policies. I don't think there are a lot of people who are here tonight who are enthusiastic about the Obama administration's Middle East policies. This is a debate about
That's the vote I want, actually.
Well, I know that's the vote both of you want. You're doing a very good job of turning it into a debate about Obama's administration policies. But this is supposed to be a debate about a particular initiative, which is the nuclear deal.
Right.
As Suzanne said at the beginning, this is not a deal to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons in perpetuity. Nobody says that. This is a deal to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons for the next 15 years. Does it do that? I think the biggest argument that's been made against that is that the verification process is not tough enough and not stringent enough. I know a lot about verification and about intelligence collection tactics to verify a deal. It is, let me tell you, infinitely easier to work to verify if the other side is cheating if you have inspectors who can go inside on the ground. Even if they can't go anytime, anywhere, it's 10 trillion times easier if they're on the ground looking around. It's also a lot easier if you have an international agreement that says, here's the standards of behavior that Iran is going to have to hold up to. At the end of the day, any verification system depends upon the United States intelligence community and how good it can do its job. I think this deal significantly enhances the capacity of the American intelligence community to do that. It also depends on the ability of our allies, particularly Israel, to be able to do that. And here's where I go back to the point I made about my friend Ephraim Halevi. He says, quite rightly, the Mossad will be better able to verify this deal than it is to be able to verify the current status quo. Is it perfect? No. Is the Obama administration pursuing the perfect foreign policy in the Middle East? No. But is this deal worthy of being voted in favor of? I think the answer is
yes. Bruce, do you believe in snapback? Given what we know and what we hear by defenders of the deal, and it's absolutely true about the imminent collapse of the sanctions regime internationally, in the event that, in fact, it were verified that they were cheating, do you believe that snapback or any serious...
I believe that this deal has moved further towards snapback than we've ever seen before. The proof of the pudding will come when the moment of violation occurs. The United States not only has the option of snapback, the United States at that moment will also have all of its other options, including use of the military option. We're not foregoing any of those options.
But I want to introduce, this will be the last question I put before you, and then we'll go to closing remarks. You both have talked, Suzanne, you at length, about the lack of appetite within the international community and the P5 plus one partners to continue economic sanctions, and that is a reason by which the negotiations had to reach a conclusion and why the deal should be verified and upheld as written. But doesn't that suggest, and this is one thing the critics bring up, that if there is a legitimate disagreement over verification and compliance, that the very same partners who are no longer interested in economic sanctions and have believed that they have run their course not only politically, but they no longer want to create economic dislocations for their very own populations for political and other strategic reasons, will not, to use your phrase in a different context, go to the mattresses to require verification of Iran, and that Iran can, by dragging this process out, keep going what we in the international community would like to block?
I think we're going to be tested, as Bruce has said, during the implementation phase, and it's going to test the alliance that we've put together to bring us to this date. I agree with some of the criticisms of the deal. I think it will be difficult, if not impossible, to ever achieve this level of international economic pressure on Iran. As I said, we never achieved it before. But the simple reality is it's not going to stay if we disapprove the deal. We don't sustain our alliances if we tear up an agreement that they have already committed to.
All right. With that, I want to let you know we are out of time for the back and forth. It's been an extraordinarily vibrant and lively back and forth. I think you would all agree. Let's give a round of applause to our four panelists. Now, we're going to hear...
Not partisan, vibrant.
I said vibrant.
Yes, I said vibrant. Yes.
I didn't say partisan. I said vibrant.
Vibrant.
The wordsmith is working on the wordsmith.
No, I defer. No.
Yeah, I said vibrant. Here we go.
I know I'm a Peruvian.
So we are going to have another vote, as I promised earlier, as we sort of beat into your heads earlier. We're going to have a vote. We're going to take one of the options away from you, though. You can no longer say you're undecided. We want to know whether you think the Congress should vote to approve or disapprove the deal. Text number one, if you think Congress should approve of the deal. Text number two, if you think Congress should disapprove the deal. Now, we're going to have closing statements from all four. The polling will close as soon as Senator McCain concludes his remarks. You can gather by that he will be the last of the speakers giving closing remarks. Each speaker will have 2 minutes, and we will start with Bruce Riedel. Bruce.
I encourage you all to continue to vote undecided and to throw this thing up in the air and make it more complicated,
exactly.
Because this really is a complicated
exactly.
issue. Final point I would make to you is this. Right now, the United States and its allies have successfully concluded an agreement in the Middle East. It's the first one in 17 years that the United States has successfully concluded in the region. And what it has done is put Iran in the pariah box as the country that has violated international norms and has failed to live up to its obligations after it signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. The Congress of the United States has an enormous task in front of it, and it's very important that they do it. It's very important that we hear how each and every congressman and senator votes. But at the end of the day, I don't want the Congress of the United States to put us as the outlier, to put the United States as the partner to this deal that was the first to renege on going forward with it. I think the Congress has been put in an awkward position. Frankly, I don't think you negotiated the negotiations for talking about the deal very well on the Hill. You put yourself in a position where if you vote no against it, you then become the problem and the United States becomes the problem. That would not be good for American leadership in the region, for American leadership around the world. What we need is to now find out, if this deal goes forward, how can we better ensure that its implementation leads to all of the outcomes we want. First, that Iran does not get a nuclear weapon, not now, not in 10 years, and not later. And secondly, that we address those other issues which both the Senator and Leon have rightly pointed out we need to put on the table for multilateral and unilateral measures between the United States and Iran.
That was precisely 2 minutes, Bruce. Well done. Leon? You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. I think it's ironic that we begin, that people will begin to be concerned about the consequences to American leadership in the region and the world in their attitude towards this deal, when in fact we have been witnessing an attrition of American leadership in the region and the world for many years now. I think that this deal, and as I said earlier, I'm not against it apocalyptically because, as I said, I do not think it changes our strategic situation in kind, but merely in degree. You know, my heart sinks when I hear my friend Bruce, who was a proponent of the deal, mention that we can always use the military option. That means that this deal, that's correct, by the way, but that means that this deal has not advanced us beyond the strategic situation that troubles us to begin with. I worry very much that this deal is the latest expression of a certain spirit in American foreign policy that I regard as responsible for some of the disasters that we've been witnessing in the region and in the world. I think that it was not ipso facto the case that the Iranians, who, as Senator McCain said, came to the table under duress and not out of an idealistic desire, and not because they read Saul Alinsky or Reinhold Niebuhr, who came to the table under duress, that it was ipso facto the case that we could not have gotten a tougher deal with the Iranians. If it is the fact that this deal is in their interest, if it is the fact that they're hurting so badly economically, if it is the fact that they really do want to renounce nuclear weapons, then it seems perfectly obvious to me that it's wrong to have ruled out the possibility of a tougher negotiating position and, more generally, of a tougher position regarding this repulsive regime in Tehran. The United States is historically the only country that will ever create obstacles and impediments to certain evils in the world. There is no other country where, without American leadership, then there will not be the obstacles and the impediments to which I'm referring. And it seems to me that what we have, that the adoption of this deal, which of course will be adopted, would be a very fine occasion to begin a new discussion of the first principles of American foreign policy after both Bush and Obama.
Leon, thank you very much. Suzanne?
Well, there we go. We can actually change the question for this debate because I think we agree perhaps on more than we disagree. I share all of the aspirations that Senator McCain and Leon Wieseltier have expressed for greater American leadership in the Middle East and the grave and strategic and humanitarian tragedy that is unfolding before our eyes today. I also share their abhorrence of Iranian policies that are primarily responsible for many of these threats that are unfolding in the region. I oppose normalization or rapprochement both as unhelpful and unrealistic. But that's not what this deal is, and that's where we disagree. Where we disagree is whether an imperfect solution to the most urgent, but certainly not the only part of Iran's threat, is one that we should, in fact, move forward with to test the possibilities of whether we can, after 36 years, begin to mitigate some of the challenges that Iran poses to our interests in the region and around the world. I believe it's an imperfect solution for two simple reasons. One, we have an international coalition. We couldn't negotiate this deal on our own. We needed the leverage that was provided by all of our allies contributing to the sanctions pressure. Two, simply because of the realities of negotiations. The Bush administration originally opposed Iran having nuclear anything, nuclear dentistry, as one of my colleagues used to say at the State Department. But by the time President Bush moved into his second term, he recognized that he had to come to the table and offer a deal that Iran might see in its interest. That's the only kind of a deal that's going to hold. Where we disagree is what the consequences of disapproving this deal would mean. Walking away from this deal would leave Washington with less influence, not more, at the very moment when the role of a responsible global superpower is sorely needed. We should be doubling down on the strategies, on the bipartisanship that brought us to this these negotiations and to this agreement. We should use it to build a larger coalition on the broader range of concerns that we have with respect to Iran.
Suzanne, thank you. I think there's something we can all agree on. We're all forthrightly opposed to nuclear dentistry. Senator McCain, before I give you the floor for the last 2 minutes, I want to remind folks the polls will close as soon as Senator McCain wraps up his remarks. So if you want to vote, please take your time to do so now. Senator McCain, wrap us up. You have 2 minutes.
About 20 minutes. I thank you, Major, for some very excellent questions in conducting this. I want to thank Bruce and Suzanne also for very articulate presentation of their point of view. And, of course, a man gifted with poetry, I am always proud to be in his company. My friends, I'm concerned about the verification aspects of this agreement, especially from where we began and the statements were at the beginning and where we ended up. I'm concerned about the relaxation of any restriction on developments of ICBMs. You develop ICBMs to deliver nuclear weapons. I'm concerned about the relaxation on the prohibition of conventional weapons, which obviously are being used throughout the Middle East today. The money is really something that bothers me as much as anything else, because right now there's 230,000 Syrians have been slaughtered. Millions of them have fled, and we're now seeing the consequences of it. We all know that Bashar Assad was about to fall, and the Iranians brought in Hezbollah, the 5,000 of them, and then they brought in weapons, and then the barrel bombing started, and now then the poison gas was used. Someone needs to show me what the Iranians are going to do with these additional funds of $100 billion as they attempt to extend their hegemony throughout the region. Has there been any indication of any slight change in Iranian behavior? So I think it's a very bad deal, because I believe it puts the Iranians on the path to nuclear weapons in 10 years, a blink of an eye in the Middle East. But I'm concerned about the implications of this agreement, as we basically legitimize this regime, which is the world's greatest sponsor of terror. And that, frankly, is what keeps me awake at night. And when I see all of us, when our hearts are broken, as we see these children, when we see a little baby washed up on the shore, on the beach, it breaks our hearts. And a lot of those things did not have to happen. And this agreement, I'm afraid, may facilitate other crises of this nature. I thank you.
Senator McCain, thank you very much. The polls are now closed. I just want to say one thing. It's rare in this city to have an assemblage as distinguished as this, and it's rarer still to see them engage each other as directly as they did, as forcefully as they did, but to disagree agreeably. So I want to give them a round of applause, and I want to invite you to join me in that really great discussion. I also
just want to add this thought, because there is a sense, or there could be a sense, that because the White House has secured the requisite votes in the Senate, that this is anticlimactic. I don't think this debate is anticlimactic. I don't think it will be on the Hill. I think everything said in public about what this deal is or isn't is important to the historical record, not just for this administration, but for the next administration, because this deal is going to survive. And everything that everyone in the policy field and politics says about this will resonate for many years. And for that, I want to thank the panelists as well. With your indulgence, I'm going to ask the panelists to stay here for just a second. I'm going to walk off stage. I'll get the results of the poll we took before and after, and I'll be right back. So give me just one second. Don't you feel the American Idol sort of tension in the room? I know I feel it. All right, for those of you curious, and I count myself among those, 73% of you before our conversation felt Congress should approve the deal, 15% said Congress should disapprove, and 12% undecided. After the debate, 85% felt Congress should approve, and 15% still believe Congress should disapprove. That, ladies and gentlemen, are our final results, 16% variation from before and after. So one more time, a big round of applause for our four panelists. They were fantastic. Thank you.